listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Far From the Maddow Crowd by Joe Pompeo, with photographs by Annie Leibovitz. It may surprise people to hear Maddow speak so matter-of-factly about someone whose views are abhorrent to her, but Maddow has never shied from respectful engagement with her ideological adversaries. The early days of her MSNBC program featured amiable debates with Pat Buchanan. She was friendly with Roger Ailes, who blurbed one of her books. She told Stephen Colbert in 2019 that she had a lot of respect for Sean Hannity. It was Carlson who gave Maddow her first paid TV gig when she began appearing on MSNBC's Tucker back in 2005. Carlson spoke admiringly of her in a 2019 New York Times Magazine profile, and when his name came up as we fished, Maddow recalled bumping into him at an event for the first time in a long time. "It was really nice to see him," she said. A few months later, I asked Maddow what she thought of the Times' recent series that unpacked how Fox News Channel's number one host weaponizes his viewers' fears and grievances to create what may be the most racist show in the history of cable news. What Maddow found most interesting about the series, she told me, was an interactive analyzing Carlson's rhetoric from 1,150 episodes of Tucker Carlson Tonight. "For me," she said, "more than the issue of, you know, how dangerous are Tucker's ideas and how do they interact with the growth of the authoritarian right in the Republican Party, more so than that question, which is obviously what the central thrust of the reporting was about, I was interested in how they deconstructed why it works." Rather than engaging on Carlson's politics, Maddow talks about him and other cable news rivals as fellow practitioners. "If you think about baseball players," she said, "who are extremely competitive and who are fighting to win and who have rivalries, and some of those rivalries are bitter rivalries, that doesn't mean you don't study the pitching technique of their star pitcher. It doesn't mean you don't appreciate whatever they're doing in terms of, you know, where they put their shortstop in order to give them a better defense. There's a sort of, like, respecting the game in terms of people who are doing well and people who are good at it. I mean, that was the basis of my professional friendship with Roger Ailes. I wanted tips from him about how to be better on TV, and he was willing to talk to me about what I was doing well and doing poorly to help me get better." Of course, Maddow, being great on TV, can't neutralize Trump conspiracy theories or save democracy. The stakes of this competition are significantly higher than a World Series ring. Maddow had been in the business for about a decade by the time she truly began to cultivate an audience. This was back in 2008, when Griffin gave Maddow her own show. 9 years earlier, she'd retreated from London to Western Massachusetts to finish her dissertation for Oxford, where she'd been a Rhodes Scholar. Since her teen years in California's Bay Area, filled with volleyball tournaments and swim meets and the emotional cliff dive, as Maddow put it, of coming out at 17 during her freshman year at Stanford, Maddow had been a passionate and driven activist for the AIDS crisis, the subject of her doctoral research. If you'd have asked anyone from her inner circle back then, that's where they thought Maddow was headed professionally. Then, on a whim, she won a contest to host a local radio show. "It was just hilarious," says Chuck Bayless, one of Maddow's oldest friends. "None of us could have ever guessed this trajectory." Local radio led to Air America, which led to regular appearances on MSNBC, which led to a political analyst gig, which led to substitute hosting for Countdown with Keith Olbermann. And finally, just 2 months before Barack Obama's historic election, Maddow's own hour as Olbermann's lead-in. In our very first show meeting, she said, I want to do a 15 to 20 minute opening, recalls Griffin, who's now working with Mad Al to build Surprise Inside. And I went, whoa, that's radical. So I said, okay, let's see if it works. She did that first day. She beat Larry King, virtually unheard of at the time, and she created something brand new. Those epic openers continue to distinguish Mad Al's now weekly show. In a 17-minute, 26-second monologue that kicked off the May 16th episode, 2 days after 10 African Americans were gunned down by a white supremacist inside a Buffalo supermarket, Mad Al gave viewers a long and winding history lesson that stretched back to the 1940s, when a fascist mob set upon black workers in Detroit, and Theodore Bilbo embraced the now ubiquitous Great Replacement Theory during his Senate re-election campaign. It is not a new concept, she said, her voice rising as she peered into the camera. It's not even a new pretext, a new justification for violent racist terrorism. It has long been so. It is right now being newly popularized, newly mainstreamed by the biggest names in conservative media, and even by the leadership of the Republican Party in Congress. But it is an old idea. It is an old and stupid idea. It is an old and stupid and dangerous idea. Old, stupid, and dangerous in equal measure. During Donald Trump's presidency, when Mad Al became a bellowing soothsayer for the anti-Trump resistance, her monologues delved into the spy novel-worthy esoterica of the Russian collusion saga and the Christopher Steele dossier, the credibility of which took a hit last year when one of Steele's main sources was indicted on a charge of lying to the FBI. If you're looking for a whiff of controversy around Mad Al's journalistic record, this would be it. The critical takes of her Russiagate coverage didn't just come from Mad Al's tormentors on the right. Slate's TV critic diagnosed a case of conspiracy brain. The Post Wimple, in a blistering series about media coverage of the unverified dossier, excoriated Mad Al for a pattern of misleading and dishonest asymmetry. Michael Ezikoff, a longtime Mad Al guest and fellow Russiagate chronicler, asked on his podcast, "Do you accept that there are times that you overstated what the evidence was?" By mid-2019, as I reported back then, Mad Al had become too hot for the newsroom management of the New York Times. Aside from her Russia coverage, they viewed her as a raging partisan, and the paper indicated that its reporters should steer clear of doing her show. The fact that it didn't last long, Mad Al told me of the informal ban, when I paid a second visit to her neck of the woods, and they just quietly changed their minds without ever saying why they changed their minds, was, to me, sort of just sad on their part, and telling. It was 3 months after our ice fishing trip, and I was back in Western Mass, this time sitting with Mad Al on her screened-in porch, eating sandwiches on a rainy spring day. We talked about pretty much everything, her spirituality and Catholic upbringing. I 100% believe in the power of prayer. Her history of depression, very much a chemical and biological process, which she manages with exercise and sleep. Her media diet, no physical publications, or, no joke, cable news, lots of digital subscriptions, and the Great British Baking Show. We also got into a back and forth about her dossier segments. Trying to turn the Russia scandal into the dossier, or trying to turn the dossier into the Russia scandal, is a revisionist history designed to intimidate people out of covering stories like that in the future, she said, and to try to obscure the seriousness of what Russia did and what the Trump campaign's relationship was with what Russia did. I suggested that Mad Al's coverage may have given viewers a false sense of hope that Trump was about to get taken down, not unlike how, say, viewers of Newsmax may have been led to believe that the 2020 election was about to be overturned. At this point in our conversation, Maddow did something very Maddow, reaching back into the past to make a point about the present. "Do you remember what the Dan Rather scandal was about?" she said, referring to a 2004 controversy in which the legendary newsman's career came to a screeching halt over a 60-minute segment based on allegedly forged documents that CBS News failed to authenticate. There was a document that was involved. He was reporting on, like, how did George W. Bush avoid going to Vietnam? How was his National Guard service arranged? Why did he get this coveted spot in this group that wasn't going to be fighting? The story of George W. Bush getting a sweet gig in the National Guard so he didn't have to go fight in Vietnam was true. Somebody giving Dan Rather a forged document so he had a screwed-up news story about it is fascinating, and it's an interesting thing about CBS News. But it doesn't mean that the National Guard thing about George W. Bush was not true. It neutralized it. Like it made that go away. And the whole thing became a Dan Rather scandal. That's what's going on with the dossier. The property where Maddow and Mikula live spans 12 acres of woods and streams. Lots of room for their two black labs, Frances and Charms, to run free. There's a duck pond, a swimming hole, a beautifully tended garden, and a veggie patch bursting with asparagus, garlic scapes, lettuce, and a gazillion herbs. When Maddow first came to Western Massachusetts in September 1998, it was almost a fluke. She needed a place to hunker down and finish her dissertation without any distractions, and she knew someone who had a spare room in a former B&B. I had no interest in New England, no interest in the country, no interest in winter, no interest in snow, Maddow said. I figured, oh, that's perfect, like I'll be totally miserable and that'll make me want to get out of here. But Maddow fell in love, first with the landscape and the seasons, which she had never experienced growing up in California, and then with Mikula, who had hired her to do odd jobs in the same house where they live to this day. They keep an apartment in Manhattan. I fell in love as soon as I saw her. I didn't end up doing much work. Showing me around under a steady drizzle, Maddow talked about the project that had been consuming most of her bandwidth, an historical narrative nonfiction podcast in the vein of Bagman, except this time set in World War II-era America. She led me to a second-floor annex that doubles as Mikula's art studio and Maddow's home office, with stacks of archival documents neatly arranged on the floor and a whiteboard scribbled with plot points. The podcast, scheduled to debut this fall, was her first pitch under the Surprise Inside umbrella. "It's an American history, underappreciated story," said Maddow, "that has resonance for all these things we're dealing with today, the threat of authoritarianism, and the question of whether or not criminal law is the appropriate venue, and has the right constitutional powers to handle those kinds of threats. It's about journalism and journalistic ethics, and the ability of powerful people to manipulate American systems." She sold an accompanying book to Crown. Maddow's other projects include another podcast, another book, two potential movies, and two potential TV shows, one of which actually sounds a little more than potential. It revolves around a group of women in post-World War II America in Washington, D.C., says Susan Rovner, the NBC Universal executive who oversees the company's television entertainment portfolio. Rovner said there was a decent chance the show could air in 2023 on NBC's streaming service Peacock, which, to be honest, could use a high-wattage period drama if it expects to tussle with HBO Max and Netflix. In this new multi-platform realm, the measure of success for someone like Maddow is not as cut and dried as in the traditional cable universe, where you know how successful you are based on how many people watch your show every night, which is in turn a measure of how many brands want to advertise during your commercial breaks. For years, millions of people tuned into the Rachel Maddow Show as nightly appointment viewing, Will her future projects inspire the same loyalty? What will success look like for, say, a long-form Rachel Maddow podcast, or limited series, or film adaptation? Is it the number of streams, critical acclaim, box office numbers? This is going to be a disappointing answer, she says, but for me, success is doing work that I'm proud of. It's about feeling like I am free to do what I want, and to say what I want, and to talk about things that I think are important, and to contribute something that wouldn't necessarily have been contributed had I not been the one working on it. Back on her porch, Maddow talked about the physical toll her work had taken over the years, schlepping back and forth between Manhattan and Massachusetts every week, feverishly toiling at a desk 10 hours a day, every day, with bad posture and a dash of scoliosis. In March 2017, as she was settling into middle age, it all finally caught up with her. I was underneath my desk, trying to plug in the laptop, she recalled, and I just felt, it felt like a balloon burst inside my back, a wet popping feeling that was absolutely disgusting. I collapsed on the ground and I could not move. A couple months later, Maddow's doctor diagnosed herniated disc in her thoracic vertebrae and gave her an injection for temporary pain management. After a day or so, she began to develop a severe rash and swelling so bad that it puffed her eyes shut. She went to the hospital, where they determined she was having a rare, potentially life-threatening allergic reaction. That was super scary, she told me. But it resolved, and I started doing a new kind of physical therapy that ended up being really effective. She said the new work routine has been a significant life improvement. It doesn't mean this is easy or idyllic, but it is different, and that's what I needed. Maddow's withdrawal from the nightly news cycle comes at a moment of alarming upheaval. The world is on fire, figuratively and literally. Americans' rights are being rolled back. We've lost a sense of collective truth. Maniacs and racists massacre innocent people, innocent children, and our leaders are too polarized or too feckless to take any meaningful action. Extremists are ascendant. Authoritarianism is en vogue, and with 2 years to go until the 2024 election, our system of government faces arguably its biggest crisis since the founding of the Republic. 2024 is going to be, not a dress rehearsal, Maddow said. This is the playoffs. You know what I mean? Like, this is high stakes, really important and determinative of our future as a country. And that's not a fatalistic thing. That's an edge of my seat kind of thing. That's how I feel. I don't feel fatalistic about it. I feel like I'm on the edge of my seat, and I'm convinced of the importance of this moment. Depending on how it all shakes out, viewers might end up seeing more of Maddow than they think. The last time she and I caught up before my final deadline in mid-June, it was the thick of the January 6th hearings. Maddow was back in New York, back on the air, co-anchoring nightly primetime recaps from MSNBC studios at 30 Rock. It was a big moment for the network, and Maddow was fully in the game, not off burying her nose in historical research for some project that wouldn't see the light of day until months or years down the line. Perhaps that's why she so firmly rejected the premise of my follow-ups about staying relevant and her legacy and all of that. I'm still working. I mean, I know 49 is old, she said, with a hint of sarcasm, but I've just done like 8 hours of live primetime television in the past week. I'm going back for another two tonight. I'm going to be here every night, working for the next few weeks or so. I reframed the question. What does she want her legacy to be? Her answer this time was short and to the point. I want to be proud of my life. We'll be right back. Fast Company by Lily Annalick. In a trove of never-before-seen letters, the unlikely, uneasy friendship between Joan Didion and Eve Bavitz comes to electrifying life in the fast-lane social and literary milieu of 1960s L.A. Opening photo, paper trail. The letter Eve Bavitz wrote Joan Didion, each shown on this spread in Julian Wasser's photos, lives at the Huntington Library in California. And a 1972 correspondence in which Bavitz castigates Didion. When I met Eve Bavitz in the spring of 2012, she was living in a one-bedroom condo in a sun-faded building on a quiet block in West Hollywood. Entering was difficult, nearly impossible. Why isn't easy to explain. There was, first of all, Eve's radical strangeness. This sounds, I realize, like a polite way of calling her nuts. And she was nuts. Huntington's disease had been eating away at her brain for years. But she wasn't only nuts, and she wasn't always nuts. There were plenty of lucid moments. The problem was the stench, black, foul, choking, that surrounded the condo like a force field. If intense fascination with someone is love, then I loved Eve, and the intensity of my fascination was what finally allowed me, 6 months after our first encounter, to breach the force field, make it past the front door. The lights were off, the shades drawn tightly against the California sunshine. I waited for my vision to adjust. It did, and I gasped. What I saw was full-scale filth, trash, several years' worth, piled on every surface, crammed into every crevice, so that it seemed to be growing from the floor, the furniture, the walls, so that it seemed alive, like a species of jungle plant. There was no room to sit or even stand, really, and the smell, that thick, hot stink, was so strong my nostrils were clogged with it. When the people from Jewish Family Services came to clean the condo, they worked in hazmat suits, lest you think I'm exaggerating or overstating. If I had any hopes that Eve kept records or personal papers, they were dashed the instant I crossed the threshold of Unit 2 at 951 North Gardner Street. Nothing could survive an environment so putrid and putrefying. Not even Eve, who succumbed to Huntington's on December 17, 2021, age 78. Yet something did survive. In the deepest reaches of a closet was a stack of boxes packed by Eve's mother decades before. The boxes were pristine, the seals of duct tape unbroken. Inside, journals, photos, scrapbooks, manuscripts, and letters. No, inside a lost world. This world turned for a certain number of years in the late 60s and early 70s, and was centered in a two-story rental in a down-at-heel section of L.A., the Franklin Avenue scene, I call it, for reasons that will become apparent. And it had all the explosive vitality that the scene at Le Deux Majeux on the left bank had for Ernest Hemingway and his fellow Lost Boys. It was the making of one great American writer, the breaking, and then the remaking, and thus the true making of another. These two writers were friends, enemies as well. They were also women, a fact fundamental rather than incidental, as you'll see from the below letter. It's dated October 2nd, no year, though the year is 1972. It's unsigned, though is from Eve. It's addressed to Dear Joan. Joan, as in Joan Didion, though the dear is either sarcastic or misplaced. And it's got the boisterous, clamorous, surging, sprawling, lewd, destructive glee of a pre-dawn, reeling, drunk temper tantrum, though it was written in the bright light of day. The closing line, goodbye, morning letter, and stone-cold sober. In 72, Eve was far more likely to F herself up on acid and or lewds and or coke than alcohol. This morning, I telephoned and wanted you to read A Room of One's Own. It's so hard to get certain things together, and especially you and Virginia Woolf, because you're mad at her about her diaries. It's entirely about you that you can't stand her diaries. It goes with Sacramento. Maybe it's better that you stay with Sacramento and hate diaries and ignore the fact that every morning when you eye the breakfast table uneasily waiting to get away back to your typewriter, maybe it's better that you examine your life in every way except the main one which Sacramento would brush aside, but which V. Wolf, and here she misspells Wolf, kept blabbing on about. Maybe it's about you and Sacramento that you feel it's undignified, not cricket, and another misspelling here, and bad form to let art be one of the variables. Art, my God, Joan, I'm embarrassed to mention it in front of you, you know, but you mentioned burning babies in locked cars, so I can mention art. Next photos, Cafe Society. The enigmatic Earl McGrath poses for a photograph. Jackson Brown in his kitchen in Glencoe. Babbitts photographed by Annie Leibovitz for Eve's Hollywood. Babbitts with Dan Wakefield in 1971. Didion photographed in 1968. Steve Martin, a lover of Babbitts's while she was on the Franklin Avenue scene. The famous photo of Marcel Duchamp and Babbitts, taken by Julian Wasser in 1963. I'm cutting Eve off. Watching her let rip is great theater, but you need a little context in order to follow. We'll go back by first going forward, jumping ahead 2 years, 1974, the year Eve published her first book, Eve's Hollywood. In the dedication she wrote, and to the Didion Dunns for having to be who I'm not. A definition of Joan that was really a definition of herself as the un-Joan. I'm ignoring Joan's husband, John Gregory Dunn, here on purpose because he failed to capture Eve's imagination. I don't like the way he writes, she noted in her journal, and I suspect she only lumped him and Joan together to needle Joan. So who was Joan in 1974? One of the biggest writers in America, a celebrity writer in the way that Norman Mailer was, or Tom Wolfe, or Hunter S. Thompson. Still more remarkable that other writers, in other words, male writers, allowed her to be a writer who was also a woman, rather than insisting she be a capital W woman writer. No modifier on writer, no flies on Joan. And now we'll go back by going back 5 years into the past. 1967, the year Eve met Joan, though the Joan Eve met was not yet Joan Didion. So who was Joan in 1967? A promising but obscure writer. Her first book, fiction, Run River, published in 1963 when she was living in New York, was assured and arresting. It was also traditional, a generational drama set in an earlier period, probably the reason critics and audiences paid it little mind. Traditional can so easily translate to unadventurous, corny, irrelevant, a painful outcome for any writer, extra painful for one who wanted to be noticed, nay, spectacular, so badly. Joan was undoubtedly a genius, but it isn't enough to be a genius. You must also be lucky, right place, right time. It was both for her next book, the nonfiction collection Slouching Towards Bethlehem, published in 1968, when she, Dunn, and their adopted daughter, Quintana, were living in L.A. at 7406 Franklin Avenue. Just as Run River felt traditional, so Slouching, with its title piece set in Haight-Ashbury, the counterculture capital, felt contemporary, alarmingly, dangerously contemporary. Remember high kindergarten, where 5-year-olds tripped on acid? It was and it wasn't. What it was an old-fashioned gothic horror story tricked out in new journalism's clothing. Sometimes, though, a costume change is all it takes. Slouching was a cultural phenomenon that made Joan one, too, in an outtake from Betsy Blankenbaker's 2001 documentary New York in the 50s. Dunn said to the camera, slouching was reviewed by someone in the New York Times, then to Joan, and it was boom, all of a sudden you were a figure. Time commissioned portraits, sending photographer Julian Wasser to the Franklin Avenue house. Wasser's series is familiar to you, even if his name isn't, because the picture you have of Joan in your mind is likely one he took. I'll jog your memory. Joan, hair flowing past her shoulders, in a long jersey dress, loose yet clinging, the expression on her face defiant, dreamy, a little bored. In several shots, she's leaning against a Corvette or sitting in the driver's seat. Her presence is romantic yet chaste. How could Joan be sexual? That savage appetites, erotic or otherwise, might snarl for satisfaction within a form so slight, an aura so cool, seems inconceivable. She's a master of the intimate close-up, gazing through the eye of the camera and directly into your eyes. It's an actor's trick rather than a writer's. Fitting, since Joan didn't have readers, as writers do. She had what movie stars have. She had fans. Joan, 33, had at last become Joan Didion, and she'd done it on the Franklin Avenue scene, her house, Earl McGrath's scene. How to explain Earl McGrath, a person who defies explanation? Eve took a crack in a letter written in late 1970 to artist Chris Bloom. "Would you like to hear about my friend Earl?" she asked, and then proceeded to detail his early life as a runaway Catholic schoolboy from Wisconsin, his amour with a future Zen monk in Big Sur, his stint as head of production at 20th Century Fox in New York. Finally, he moved to California and away from his wife, a lame Italian countess. Earl is wonderful at social masterpieces. 7406 Franklin Avenue was, in 1966, the year Joan moved in, a ramshackle house in a neighborhood in Hollywood that nobody wanted to go to. 7406 Franklin Avenue was, in 1967, the year Eve came along, the place to be. It was McGrath who brought Eve in. They met on an early morning in June 1967. Eve, 24, was lying in the bed of Peter Pilafian, electric violinist and road manager for the Mamas and the Papas, when through the front door breezed McGrath. McGrath was infatuated with Pilafian. Once he got an eyeful of a sleep-tousled Eve, though, he redirected the flow of his lovey-dovey. A romance, passionate, but not sexual, began. From Eve's letter to Bloom, "Earl invited me to dinner. I was uncomfortable at first, but Earl's personality and energy are such that once the people got inside his house, all outside social factors were dropped. He loved us with his funny, intelligent, brilliant radiance like a diamond net. The next day, he would call us all up and ask us questions like, 'What did you say to Mrs. Dunn? She thinks you are the most brilliant person in California.' Mrs. Dunn, and please note the misspelling, is how Eve refers to Joan in journals and letters from this period. McGrath had a circle. When Earl came here 2 or 3 years ago, he knew no one. After about 6 months, he had created a society of people who were not only the most talented around, but who also all shared these incredible parties. He has the best young artist, writers, actors, poets, with established people like Larry Rivers, Jasper Johns, Yuri, a white Russian who discovered the jet engine and was in the UN, Henry Getzler, and she misspells the name, even Natalie Wood, who breastfeeds her baby while wearing a mask so she won't get germs on it. McGrath also had an inner circle. In it, Joan and Dunn, Michelle Phillips, a mama in the Mamas and the Papas, Peter Pilafian, and Harrison Ford, before he was Han Solo. said Phillips. I didn't even know Harrison was an actor. I remember getting dragged to Star Wars at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning. I was sitting there watching the screen, and all of a sudden Harrison comes on, and I gasped, and I said, "That's my pot dealer." The relationship between Joan and McGrath was a long-standing one, deep and full of funny gallantry, another courtly romance in which consummation was unthinkable. In 2016, Joan told Vanity Fair, "Earl and I met in 1962, immediately loved each other and never stopped. I very clearly remember sitting on the front steps of the Franklin Avenue house talking to Earl. We gave parties together." The most storied took place on September 6, 1968, in celebration of the publication of Tom Wolfe's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Joan's nephew, Griffin Dunn, in junior high and up way past his bedtime, was a guest. I just wandered around and watched adults. Earl and Harrison went as movable art objects. Earl wore all white and Harrison wore all black. They stood back to back, and Earl in white would start a conversation with someone, then Harrison in black would continue it. I think they were stoned out of their minds. I was just waiting for Janice, and no one was really wanting to talk to a 13-year-old, except this bald guy in a Nehru jacket. He said, "Boy, come here, quick, quick." And he holds my wrist really tight and goes, "I have taken the acid and I'm having the bummer. You're the only ray of light in this horrible place." It was Otto Preminger, Austro-Hungarian-born director of Laura. Anyway, there was a parking valet, but most of the cars were stolen in front of the house. Joan complained and the valet said, "Well, I didn't know you lived in such a ratty neighborhood." In 1970, Joan published the novel Play It As It Lays, as alarming and dangerous in its contemporaneity as Slouching, and Play It was truly a product of the Franklin Avenue scene, because a nightmare version of the Franklin Avenue scene served as its backdrop. The L.A. of the very fast and very famous Hollywood L.A., but also because the Franklin Avenue scene was where Joan got her ending. Said Eve, "Michelle Phillips told the best stories in town. I remember her once lying down on the floor of my apartment during a dinner party. Joan and John were there. Earl was there and telling that amazing story about her friend Tamar. Tamar Hodel, in her mid-20s, in despair over a failed love affair, decided to kill herself. She asked a 17-year-old Phillips to help. Phillips, I begged Tamar for 3 days not to commit suicide. Finally, I said, if that's what you really want to do, I'm not going to stand in your way. Tamar took 26 Seconal, then said, I want to be dead, but I don't want to look dead. She went to the bathroom and was putting makeup on. The Seconal hit her all at once and she went down. I managed to rock her back and forth into the bed. I lay down next to her and went to sleep. The next thing I remember was John, Phillips, Michelle's soon-to-be husband, tickling my feet. An ambulance was summoned, and Hodel fortunately saved. Joan called me up the next day and said, is it all right if I use that story you told in the book I'm working on? In Play It's climax, the protagonist, Maria, lies in bed with her best friend, BZ, as he overdoses on Seconal. Maria and BZ fall asleep. They're found by Maria's husband. It's too late to summon an ambulance, and BZ, unfortunately, isn't saved. Play It wasn't just an instant bestseller, it was an instant classic. Joan was in the stratosphere now. Even ranking divinities genuflected before her. Recalled writer Josh Greenfeld, John used to say, guess who I just met on the beach? I met Jesus. Jesus said he loved Joan's work. That Joan wasn't straitjacketed into the role of woman writer was neither luck nor chance. She did it by being very, very good, and a very, very particular kind of good. A masculine kind of good is the way I would, with some trepidation, characterize it. She was the child of Hemingway, and eager to acknowledge her paternity. When I was 15 or 16, I would type out Hemingway's stories to learn how the sentences worked. she told the Paris Review. In fact, she was the son Papa always wanted, even if she was the daughter he never knew he had. Her sentences were, like his, as cold and clean as spring water. Feelings were there, and strong to the point of overpowering, though they were addressed only obliquely. To address them directly would be to violate the cowboy code. Bearing your soul? Yikes! Sissy stuff. And Joan was from Sacramento, technically a city in Northern California, really the Old West. Yet alongside this emotional reticence was an impulse to emotional pornography, to wit, Joan letting drop in Life magazine that she and Dunn were vacationing in Hawaii in lieu of filing for divorce, an impulse I would characterize with more than some trepidation as feminine. These contradictory extremes of reserve and exhibitionism, of male and female, should have canceled each other out, but didn't. The paradox was riveting, thrilling. What it means to be the un-Joan, in other words, Eve. Joan famously wrote, "It had not been accident that the people with whom I had preferred to spend time in high school had, on the whole, hung out in gas stations." It's a good line, self-revelation disguised as social commentary. Only the self being revealed is false. The people with whom Joan spent time in high school were, on the whole, middle-class strivers, like herself. Joan was on student council, sophomore ball committee, junior prom committee, and worked not just on newspaper but yearbook. Or upper-class already theirs. Joan was in the Manana Club, known locally as the Rich Girls Sorority, as was Nina Warren, daughter of Earl Warren, then governor of California. The statement was true, however, of Eve, a low-high, pop-trash, bohemian aristocrat by birth. Her mother was Cajun, a hash-house waitress-turned-artist from Sour Lake, Texas. Her father was Jewish and a virtuoso violinist from Brooklyn, a studio musician. You can hear his bow and strings shrieking along with Janet Leigh in the Psycho shower scene, and member of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Once, at a party given by her parents, she led Russian composer Igor Stravinsky by hand to American jazzman Stuff Smith, just before Smith, afflicted mightily with the DTs, was carried off on a stretcher. This was the first improbable introduction she'd make in a lifetime of Frank Zappa to Salvador Dali, Steve Martin to White Suits. Eve was a bohemian aristocrat by inclination as well. At Hollywood High, she decided that the sororities weren't for her, as the brownies hadn't been for her at Cherimoya Elementary. Joan was both a brownie and a tri-delt, and after Hollywood High, Eve picked LACC, a community college, over UCLA, because UCLA, in her view, wanted to turn its female students into educators, and no way was she letting anyone make an honest citizen out of her. Next photos, face in a crowd. The Didion Dunns at their Malibu home. Babbitts and one of her collages. Leibovitz, Babbitts's lover and Rolling Stone colleague. Graham Parsons, photographed by Babbitts at the Chateau Marmont. Various Babbitts's and Eve's godfather, Igor Stravinsky. Babbitts's photograph of the birds, which would become the art for their album Untitled, a young Harrison Ford circa 1968, and Babbitts hits the photo booth. I believe that every true artist is, in a fundamental sense, an outsider artist. Joan was a true artist, therefore Joan was an outsider artist. But she was an outsider artist from the inside, and she treated writing, a renegade pursuit, and improvisational as a career with steps to follow, a ladder to climb. Her way of keeping herself from looking down, perhaps. If she saw that the ladder was actually a tightrope, she might lose her nerve. Again and again she opted for conventional modes and stratagems. As a senior at Berkeley, she won the Vogue-sponsored Prix de Paris essay contest. During her 7 years at the magazine, she'd go from promotional copywriter to feature associate. In 1963, the year she got her book Run River published, she also got a husband, or at least a fiancé, Dunn, a Princeton man, the son of a Hartford surgeon. By 1963, Eve, too, had a husband, though he wasn't hers. Walter Hopps, director of the Pasadena Art Museum, to get back at him for inviting his wife, not inviting her, to a party he was throwing for French surrealist Marcel Duchamp, she posed for Julian Wasser. Yes, the time photographer again. A few days after the party, Wasser shot a 76-year-old Duchamp wearing a suit, playing chess with a 20-year-old Eve, wearing not a thing. In his photos of Joan and the Corvette, Joan's face is the focus. In his photo of Eve and Duchamp, Eve doesn't have a face, her features obscured by her hair. She's just a body, and that body is the antithesis of Joan's, an explosion of voluptuous flesh and helplessly carnal. Eve getting naked for the camera was more than an act of revenge against her lover. It was an act of homage to her idol, Marilyn Monroe. Eve wrote, "I used to wander down Hollywood Boulevard, hoping that Georgia O'Keeffe wasn't really just a man by accident, because she was the only woman artist, period. But then, my mother told me Marilyn Monroe was an artist, and not to worry." It's worth noting that Eve's artistic model was the opposite of Joan's. Hemingway, supremely macho, a man of action as well as letters, was a winner of Pulitzers and Nobels, of Bronze Stars and silver medals. Contrastingly, the intensely femme Monroe was the ultimate victim, an artist who was treated as a bimbo, a loser, even if she was the biggest star in the world. In Slouching, Joan wrote, "Self-respect has nothing to do with reputation, which, as Rhett Butler told Scarlett O'Hara, is something people with courage can do without." Another good line, but again, one that doesn't apply to Joan, who worked on her reputation as diligently, as carefully, as she worked on her books. The statement itself is Joan working on her reputation. It was Eve who couldn't be bothered. How having a well-managed versus a carelessly managed reputation plays out for a woman in practical terms. When I asked Julian Wasser if he told Joan how to dress or where to stand during their session, he replied, his tone reverent, "With a girl like Joan Didion, you just don't tell her what to do." When I asked him why he'd chosen Eve for the Duchamp photo, he replied, his tone contemptuous, "She was a piece of ass." Eve dropped out of LACC almost as soon as she enrolled. Her education thereafter would be of the sentimental variety. Joseph Heller, writer of Catch-22, married and in his 40s when they began their affair, tried to help her with Travel Broadens, the autobiographical novel she'd started as a teenager. "Your spelling, my dove, is even more scandalous than your impertinence," he told her in a 1964 letter. "I think it is eminently readable, but probably not publishable. I thought we ought to try anyway." The attempt would fail, and Eve, who early on was as interested in becoming an artist as a writer, switched her focus to art. She was already a regular at Barney's Beanery, an artist bar in West Hollywood. Eve, however, was not considered an artist by the other artist. All men, it goes without saying. The best she could do was inspire the Barney's artist, inspire, of course, being code for F. The Barney's artist Eve inspired Ed Ruscha, Ed Moses, Ken Price, though she stayed away from Dennis Hopper, too weird. A few of them understood what she was, an original and profound and for real, but most saw her the way Wasser did, as a piece of ass. No gallery showing was offered. She paid her bills by doing secretarial work. Eve spelled poorly, typed quickly. Yet in 1967, when she joined the Franklin Avenue scene, things were looking up. she'd switched her focus again, this time from fine arts to rock and roll arts, and from fine artist to rock and roll artist. Now, the term groupie is one Eve often assigned to herself, and in the strictest sense, she was a groupie, that is, a woman in hot sexual pursuit of rock and rollers. But really, she was a courtesan, that is, a woman in hot sexual pursuit of the men of her era who moved and shook. It just so happened that the men who moved and shook in late 60s L.A. were rock and rollers. Playing the courtesan groupie was how Eve filled herself with the spirit of her time and place. In 1966, Eve spotted a pre-famed Jim Morrison at a club on the Sunset Strip. Her first words to him were, "Take me home." Soon after, she set her sights on Jackson Browne, Don Henley, Glenn Frey. And in 1967, she got Stephen Stills to let her do the cover art for his band's next album, Buffalo Springfield Again. "I knew my early days of effing around would pay off," she told Walter Hopps in a letter from that year. For a while, everything was golden. Eve was mixing business with pleasure, and they mixed just fine. Until they didn't. Abruptly, inexplicably, McGrath turned on her. From the letter to Bloom, "Earl decided I was beyond the pale about 8 months ago. He decided I was vulgar or something." My guess is that McGrath's jealousy rather than Eve's vulgarity was the reason for the about-face, since the guys he was pining for, she was sleeping with. Not only Peter Palafian, but Harrison Ford. Said Eve, "Earl was in love with Harrison. One time, Earl and Harrison and I were taking acid at the beach. I suddenly decided we had to go home because there were too many cops around. We stopped for breakfast. Harrison started talking about working on a movie with Elliot Gould. He thought Elliot was a nice guy. Well, Earl stood up and threw all the dishes on the floor." This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.